and it cost about $1,800 a year for tuition at this private school that I went to. And so some years I didn't make enough money to pay for the tuition. And so I would write to Norm Rockness.
Mm-hmm.
And Norm Rockness, who was the superintendent, would send me whatever I needed and advance me for the next season.
Yeah.
So, and that was one of the good,
the
good things that, and it was there were no interest charged or anything. And when I got back in the spring, every year, I went to work, first of all, you know, when we first started up, before the regular crew started, you know, the early startup crew, I worked with my, you know, was a helper for my dad, who was the plumber, and it was our job to connect all of the pipes, the little 3/4-inch galvanized pipes to all of these buildings, in all the bunkhouses, and, you know, everywhere, the whole cannery. We did that for about a month.
You supplied all the water to this place?
Well, it, before it even started.
Yeah.
And then when the crew started to come in, back around May 15th or so, I would then work for Grant Brown on the docks, or Joe Means in the carpenter shop, and it depended on what they needed for at the time. For example, I was just telling you about working for Nell Swedlin.
Can you grab my computer out of the car? I forgot it. And I'll show Mr.
Amundsen the
photos that I showed Brad. And I'll I totally forgot.
What's this? Is?
Total overkill? That's perfect.
Yeah. Right. I'm sure you can hook that up to the building
we'll just show
or something.
Afterwards.
So,
well.
So I worked in the docks as a dick, you know, as a. You know, worked on the, you know, the beach gang, kind of, pre-beach gang. We weren't beach gang per se, like Walt and Jim and the other, you know, beach gang. But we were the ones that went down, you know, went over the ladders and unloaded all the tenders when they came in with all their plunder and all that, loaded the tenders. I did that in the, you know, in June, before I went fishing, I would work from about middle of April to about the 20th of June every year, every spring, this is in the 60s, mind you. This was back in the era of Martin Luther King, you know.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of that kind of mentality going on. I mean, I remember working with some of the guys that came in, and they got to eat in what they call the blue room. That's all the machinists were ate in. And, but we couldn't eat there. We had to eat in the, they segregated us off into another portion of the mess hall where the Italian mess hall is, except we ate in the back of there. We couldn't, we didn't eat up front.
No, my dad used to say about the blue room when he was superintendent, he hated eating in there. And he'd always hit in the, this was after they desegregated and everybody ate in the main mess hall. And he'd always sit in that front table with all the Filipinos. Mm-hmm. And I used to be like, oh yeah, my dad, he's such a, you know, progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And I finally asked him, I said, why do you sit there, Dad? He goes, because no one bugs me there. Wasn't exactly for, but he when he ate in the blue room, all those, you know, high executives would go in there, and he could never have any peace.
Yeah.
And so he just ate with
the. You know, it's interesting. Some of the jobs that I had in Alaska Packers, I think the best one was working at Brownie in the fall, because you know this was after everybody went home, and the village, I mean the canneries, the bunkhouses used to be. Used to be kind of like an attraction to people coming along and beating the doors down and looking for alcohol.
Oh.
So,
thank you so much.
there was about four of us that worked for Alaska Packers at that time. Don Nielsen and myself were the two that I recall. And it was our job to go around to all of the bunkhouses and go to all the rooms and snip the locks and go in and then go through their belongings looking for alcohol. And if there was alcohol, then we would, you know, do whatever we did with it.
Yeah. But
we did it. I mean, there would be, I mean, fishermen, there were some times when people had went to great pains to kind of try to avoid that, you know, what we were paid to do, you know, breaking into all the rooms. There were big signs, placards, no alcohol, please don't break this. And we'd pull the old trunk out and snip off the old 1910 lock.
It's funny you said that the signs, we're actually going, Trident's going to let us take all the old historic signs from the cannery to use in the exhibit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so the ones that say no women allowed. Yeah, they're very telling. Yeah. And songs like no drunk, public drunkenness and things like that. Yeah, yeah, they say a lot. Or don't turn on machines while before cleaning them. Just kind of... well, what do you think? We should we get started? Should we turn it on?
It's already on.
Okay. Well, we want to.
I couldn't. Okay. Let's lose any momentum. If you want to start it formally.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that. Okay, and then we'll just let the folks know. So
note of the time here, so we can let our transcription folks know.
Excellent. Okay, and Brad, do you want to do the paperwork? Would you mind filling that? And would you mind also putting your address, too? Because it's just for UAF to make sure they have a contact for you.
Okay. Is this for tree farm?
Yes.
Okay. you guys, you want me in or out?
Oh, you can definitely stay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's take a vote here.
No, we would love for you to stay, Brad. And I just think the more that you guys know about this project, I think the more, and especially as we think long term, which would be great. So thank you very much, Mr. Anguson, for meeting and talking with us today. My name is Katie Ringsmith, and I'm the director of the Inn and Cannery History Project. And you probably know me by my other name, and that's Gary's kid.
Yeah, little kid.
Most people
run around the White House.
That's right, exactly. So we decided that when we heard that the Inn and Cannery was going to be officially closed after 129 years now, Trident had decided to close it. Bob King and I were at a conference in Cordova, and we thought we needed to do something. We weren't sure what, but we needed to do something. And so with my background with the National Park Service, I thought, well, let's just at least nominate it to the National Register. And that's taken great momentum. Not only is Katmai National Park interested, but also San Francisco Maritime Historic Park, because that tells a more complete story of the canneries and the voyage north. So we're going to nominate to the National Register. We also conducted a storytelling workshop with young people in Naknek with the high school kids, and they produced stories about their connection to the canneries. And one of them actually was just nominated, accepted into the Anchorage International Film Festival in the youth category on cannery art. That was pretty exciting. And then finally, we are going to take all of the research that we are collecting right now, and we're going to develop a museum exhibit with the State Museum in Juneau called Mug Up that will tell the story, not just of the fishermen, but the processors, the people who put food on people's table all around the world. And we're using the Inn and Cannery as a frame to walk people through and to give them a firsthand experience of what, you know, these canneries were like. And we figure if you tell one cannery story, you can really tell all of them. And what this particular interview is going to be for, we're working with UAF Project Jukebox and doing interviews on people who worked at the canneries and who can help us better understand the activities that occurred on the historic landscape. So that's the project, and I really appreciate you taking the time today to sit with us. So before we kind of get into talking about the cannery, maybe we could talk a little bit about you, and you can give me a little bit of biographical information for our listeners. So today is December 13th, 2018, and we are at the Alaska Peninsula Corporation headquarters in Anchorage, Alaska. And so, first of all, can you please state your name?
Trevon Anguson, Jr. I was born in South Naknek, or Sevenoski, in 1947, and I've been involved with Alaska Packers my entire life, from the time I was knee-high to a grasshopper, because my mom and dad both worked for the cannery. So our cannery life was from the beginning to where we are today, and I've gone from working, as soon as I turned 18, I was hired. Old enough to work at the cannery, I went to work early May, and was gone at the end of September every year. But I took about 30 days off in the summer to go fishing for Alaska Packers. And for the first 10 years or so, I leased the company boat. They had, the company, back in the 60s, they owned all of the boats.
Right.
And if you didn't lease a company boat, you didn't fish for them. And there were a lot of people that were excluded from the fishery because they didn't have the methods and means to harvest. And Alaska Packers NN had one of the largest fleets in Bristol Bay.
Right.
And so, my dad, was able to lease a boat from Alaska Packers, and him and my brother, older brother, fished for them. While he was doing that, he purchased two skiffs that used to be kind of like dory boats for Diamond O, one of the old canneries from NN, and we set netted down in Diamond and Beach.
Wow.
And I did that until I was 14.
Can you tell me very quickly what your father's name is?
Trevon Anguson, Sr.
Senior, right.
Yeah.
And did you grow up at South Naknek or at Sevenoski?
I grew up both places. Early on, I was born in Sevenoski, but when I went to school, we moved down to South Naknek.
And how did the village of Sevenoski get started?
They migrated, the people from Sevenoski migrated down from the Katmai National Park in the village of Old Sevenoski up in the Sevenoski River when the New Varuta happened in 1912. Yeah, 1912. The people migrated down, moved from Sevenoski and settled 7 miles up from the Naknek Point on the south side and called it Sevenoski.
And your father was living in Old Sevenoski.
Yes, he was born in Old Sevenoski, and I was born in New Sevenoski.
Okay, and that was 1912, and then the village of Sevenoski was established. And then, the canneries, Alaska Packers, they had started the canneries then. And by 1919, with the World War One had been engaged, and the Packers were sending canned salmon to France to feed the troops, and as a result, a lot of things happened. One, in Naknek, exactly 100 years ago this year, the Spanish flu pandemic hit. You, of course, weren't alive at that time, but do you have any, are there any stories or memories of the flu pandemic?
My mom's parents died from that. She was born in Ugashik. She was an orphan.
Yeah.
Actually, it wasn't the 1919 flu, the pandemic, that I think the more devastating one was the 1927 epidemic down in the peninsula.
Oh.
That seemed to be the one that had the most impact because there was probably in the 1919 era, there was very little connection between the outer communities and the center of the universe in Bristol Bay at that time.
Right.
So I would surmise that because my mom in Ugashik and their family down in, and the family up in Sabinoski weren't really impacted as severely as they could have been, except for when they became exposed to it in 1927, in that era when my mom was 2 years old, she became an orphan.
Yeah.
And that particular flu was when people, Sabinoski, virtually became a ghost town.
Right.
In that era, from that time. I remember, you know, the development, the layout of that community, of New Sabinoski. They had boardwalks, they had running power, and all of that. I mean, it was just kind of like, you know, the Incas in the early settlement. I mean, it was really forward, really developed for a village that was way out of the ordinary.
Yeah.
But in 1927, it began to self-destruct.
Yeah.
To the time in 1947, there were only about five families living there then. But before that, there were a lot of communities, a lot of houses. What people did, because there's no wood in the community, they would once people abandoned their homes, people started to tear down the homes and use them for firewood.
Yeah.
So that's what happened to Sabinoski.
And it just went away.
You would think that there would be some relics. You know, but there's nothing.
Just the church left.
Just the church and Carlos.
Yeah, I had the opportunity to go to Sabinoski. I've been up there a few times looking.
I used to be an altar boy in that church.
Yeah, I've been to the church, right.
Yeah, my godfather was a reader. His name was, his name was One Arm Nick, but we called him Dotta. And he was he was the reader. And so we would... We lived and died by the church, but unfortunately, you know, it gets away from you to the point where we don't live the way we used to live.
Yeah.
I mean, Lenting was really, back in those days, you know, we couldn't play, we couldn't eat until we saw the first star, and no meat, no nothing, you know, just basic staple.
Mm-hmm.
But backbones from dry fish. I mean, things were really Spartan. But today it's a different world.
Right, it is.
But you know, Alaska Packers, I have to say one thing though. There were two things that's come to mind with Alaska Packers when I was growing up. Before I even started working there or before things started to happen. One, my mom and dad had real good friendships, which developed some real close friendships with some of the Italian fishermen. They would come up and chop the wood for her smokehouse, and they would help her with the strips, and Louis Grillo and that group would come up and every day and tend the fires and everything. And they would get some of the fish to take home with them. But the thing that they left behind was all the fishermen that owned... the Italian fishermen, the outside fishermen, they were in a different system then. They fished differently. You know, the arrangement for them fishing for Alaska Packers on their company boats were different than they were for us who fished, you know, as independents. We leased our boats from the Alaska Packers. The outside fishermen didn't lease the boat. They had the cannery took a third, the skipper took a third, and the deckhand took a third, and the cannery front-loaded all of the costs. They paid for all the groceries and all the transportation and all of the supplies for that fisherman. But how we benefited was at the end of the season, the fishermen, they're supposed to turn their food back, you know, all their canned goods back to the provisions warehouse, and, you know, that would be heated all year so that they can use the canned goods again in the next year. All of the fishermen would put all their canned goods and their food from their boat into gunny sacks, and at night they would carry them up to my mom's house. And I remember our big windbreak was just, I remember the corner of the windbreak was stacked with gunny sacks. And, you know, it was our job to to stock the shelves that we had in our basement with all these canned goods. And, you know, to this day, I prefer canned fruit over fresh fruit, and that's a given. Huh. I prefer sardines over smoked salmon, would you believe?
Really?
Yes, because there was always lots of sardines. I would eat sardines, and then I would prefer olive oil over Wesson oil.
Interesting.
And that's the way I grew up.
Yeah.
And so that's the impact that the canneries, the Italians, they would come to the house and they would cook. We would put together big parties to go down. We would jump in our jalopies and run down to Diamond and Beach, and they would dig clams for us. We would dig clam, buckets and buckets of clams, and they would come up to the house and they would soak them out, and they would cook it, you know, steam them with garlic, and bring their French bread and their wines and their, you know, we would just. And that's how I grew up.
Nice. Well, speaking of growing up, let's talk about one of the things that I really like to explore are how children and young people remember the cannery. I was a cannery kid. Brad's a cannery kid. And it sounds like you are a cannery kid, too. So as a child growing up at the cannery in the 1950s.
It was our playground. I remember it was a good example. This dock here, this inside dock. We used to love to go down here at the end of the season, you know, when the cannery was abandoned. We would take our bicycles and just go. It was just a Shangri-La for kids on bicycles. And I remember that I put my, there's a boat there, 1 foot, 10 by 10 or 12 by 12 bullhead, bulk rail, what they call a bulkhead.
Mm-hmm.
At the dock to keep people from stumbling over.
Yeah.
I remember one time as a kid, I put my bicycle up on that thing, and I pedaled out, and I lost my balance, and I fell over the dock. And you could see where I landed. Big impact. Big rocks all around me. I didn't get any.
On the sand,
get hit,
huh?
But I hit the sand, and you could see a big indentation.
Mother know?
No. I mean, my sisters will still talk about that because they were there and they come running down and everything else. But the cannery as a kid, we would always get chased off. Freddie Grinnell and somebody only got, you know, they would come down and Grant Brown. We were always looking for things to scrounge. It was, you know, it was like a, especially in these open warehouses with boats, we knew that, you know, we knew that there was gasoline in them engines and, you know, we could siphon little hoses and fill up for all jalopies. Nobody ever got caught. And I have a feeling that they probably knew that that was going on, but they never, nothing was ever said about how, you know, these old company boats with their old, you know, with the gas engines, you know, just get a little can and siphoning hose and fill up your can and
Ralph
take
told
it down
me,
to your skiff. And
yeah. Ralph told me that you guys used to play up in the rafters.
Oh yeah,
when you were kids.
That's down Diamond M, different cannery, but that we played in the rafters, but not in the building. We played under the dock.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, the rafters were under the dock. They had little boardwalks,
mm-hmm.
little gangplanks under the docks, and we would go down there. And we liked to do that when the tide was in, because you could look down and you can see the water splashing and everything. And so, once in a while, somebody would get spooked because it was always dark under there, and we were, you know, it was just real quiet. And so we always thought that there were ghosts down there, and somebody would yell ghosts, and we'd scurry back out of there. But under the dock was a real neat place to play when we were kids. They would chase us off the top because they didn't like kids running around the cannery. Yeah. And so we would go, we'd learn how to play under the dock. And it was a lot of fun under the dock. One of the things that we used to do was to it was kind of like going through a treasure hunt for us along there, because fishermen, at the end of the season, they would throw things overboard, and it would wash up, you know, like mugs and even oranges and apples, for God's sake. I mean, they were edible.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the things that we used to do.
Yeah. So your father worked at the NN cannery, and what was his job?
Well, he used to be a winterman down in Diamond O. That's how he got started.
And then the superintendents of NN were also manager, the Diamond M and the Diamond
O,
correct?
And, yeah, because back in the early 50s or so, he was a winterman down in Diamond O.
Okay.
And so he got to run the ways down there. Uh-huh. He launched the scows. And then about the time that I turned 18, old enough to work, we worked with him down there at the ways, launching in the real early. It was a short time job, though, wasn't it? You know, you go in, you launch your boats, and you're out of there. So we would go back. When I did it, going to Diamond J.
Mm-hmm.
I was sent up there to help launch boats up there. And
Diamond J on the Quijac.
On the Quijac.
Yep.
Cagayan, working for Grant Brown up there. He was the beach boss up there. And they sent me up there to work for him, and I was there for about 3 weeks, and launching and pulling up boats and whatnot. But we would go, you know, when we were done, we would go back to work at the cannery itself, continuing the project of getting ready for the summer.
Yeah.
Did a lot of painting. I painted little pipes. I used to hate it when they used to give us little tiny brushes and tell us to go paint the pipes white. In the cannery room, you know, in the cannery itself, you know, where you have all these little water pipes, you had to paint them white. They had to be, inspection, and, you know, all that. They had to be sanitary and all. So,
right.
So it was our job every year to scrape the paint off these little white pipes and then repaint them. And that was a... You know,
I feel ya. I did. I did my chores, scraping. And,
yeah, that
and
was really something.
In the
and
spring.
So,
yeah.
That was part. You know, I never got stuck with that as much. They put me there when things were slow because they, you know, I was a big guy and they needed heavy lifters down at the front dock, and, you know, unloading all the plunder that comes in. Especially when boats come up from Seattle,
mm-hmm.
and they had to be unloaded,
yeah,
all the tenders
right.
that came up. And so we would go down into the, you know, go down and sling load and stack the pallets full of cargo. And then on the other end, when that was all done, we had to open up. I worked with the carpenters up in the swamps building that boardwalk. With Mel Swedlin, and Mugga was a real treat for us, except that Mel Swedlin was a big Swede, and he didn't believe in coffee. And I'm sitting there, buggy, hot, miserable, hungover, and saying, "Nels, the whistle just blew, it's coffee time." And he would mumble all kinds of expletive deletives and tell me to keep working. So that,
yeah.
I didn't like working for carpenters as much as I like working for Grant Brown.
Well, it seems like just the whole preparation, getting ready for the season, was almost a full year job.
Yeah, right? It was starting in late early May, and ending in September.
Yeah,
and then you had that 3 weeks in the summer that you went fishing.
Yeah, right. So you fished, but you helped. You were part of the spring fall
right.
crew that
spring
readied
and
then
both.
Closed it. And took care of it the whole time as part of the cannery caretakers. And that's I think, a really important part of this story.
Well, it was, there weren't too many of us that were really loyal to the company because the company didn't really treat everybody the same. The Angusons,
sure.
were, you know, were treated well. My mom ran the laundry.
Right, Vera.
And my dad was the plumber in the springtime, and the plumber's helper. And then he was the, you know, launching scows. Yeah. So, and he always got a boat from the cannery. There was something interesting. When Hank Bison was superintendent.
Hank Bison.
I was fishing with my dad then in 1925. It was a company lease boat, and my brother Ted and my brother Ralph were fishing in a conversion in '86. And they didn't have radios. But all the other company boats had radios. And so I always remembered his dad went up to Hank Bison and asked him for if we can get radios. And Hank turned to him and says, "Why do you want a radio? Who are you going to talk to?" And wouldn't give us radios. So, I mean, that was something, you know. I mean, when we go fishing and no radios, no compasses, I mean, just nothing. No fanometers.
Yeah.
I mean, the only thing that we had was line of sight, and you got to spend a lot of time sitting on sandbars wondering, you know, because you go dry.
Well, and the fact that you bring up a radio, I think, is pretty important. I mean, radios absolutely were the communication.
Exactly.
You know,
especially out in the fishing grounds.
Yeah.
And when you don't have a radio and don't have a good compass and no fathometer. See, the compasses that the company gave us, it came with a compass, but the compass was the Gray Marine boats' engines that were in our little wooden slabs. You know, they had magnetic magnetos in the, you know, distributor cap. And our compass was always 30 degrees off because the magnetic north always pointed toward the magneto. And so no matter what we did, we were always lost. And so that's how it was. And the other thing, when you leased the boat from Alaska Packers, Sal Abono was the fish boss. He was the boat boss. You had to live by Sal Abono's rules. You had to go see him if you wanted a net. He gave you the best, or he gave you whatever.
Yeah.
And so Sal made it very, very clear to us when we got the boats that we wouldn't have the boat for long if we anchored. And so when the wind came up, we didn't anchor. So we had to go out there and plow away into storms. I mean, some of the biggest storms come along, and if there were fish boats out there, the Alaska Packer boats were always there, because Sal Abono would run around in a monkey boat looking for you.
Wow.
And, if you were slacking off, you lost your job. And if you lost your job with a fish boat, you didn't fish for anybody.
Right.
Except for when Trevor Beeson came along for Nelbro, the local native people never really had an opportunity to fish the way that they do now. Hmm. So Nelbro came along in the mid-late 60s after Whitney, Fidalgo, and some of these other canneries. But the grip in the fleet was Bumblebee, Ralph Hendrickson, Red Salmon with... Wynn Brindle, mm-hmm. and Alaska Packers with Hank Bison.
Yeah.
They were the big three in the fishery. And if they didn't like you, you didn't fish.
Yeah.
And that's how it was.
That's how it was. So you mentioned Vera worked in the laundry, and that's a pretty important kind of...
Oh, we hated that job.
You and Ralph, did your mom hate it or just the kids?
No, what happened is mom was, for the first 10 years or so, she was a laundry helper. Emma was the laundry woman, the old lady Emma. And
was she from the community?
No. She was from Washington somewhere. They brought her up to run the laundry. And so every year, Emma would get Ralph and I down there, and she would make sure that she gave us baths, for one thing. And how she gave us baths was she put us into washing machines.
Big
things. And didn't turn them on, but just filled it up with water.
Yeah.
And so we'd sit there until we got clean. And then she would have us lug these army blankets out to hang on the sheets, and then the sheets. Yeah.
I've done that too.
Yeah, the army blankets, the sheets. We have to do all of those things for when we're 7 and 8 years old. Yeah. So, you know, that's why we hated the laundry.
Yeah.
Like my mom would kind of try to send for us, and we'd stay away and not come down. And
my memory of Vera when I was just a little kid, because she ran the laundry.
Yeah, she ran the laundry later.
You didn't mess around in there with Vera.
Yeah.
she let you have it if you got it.
Yeah, your dad came along. I remember that before your dad, there was Hank Bison and Norm Rockness. And they lived in the White House. My mom helped do the, and I used to have to go down there with her once in a while to haul out the garbage. But she did the janitorial in there for them. And they had a servant in there, a Chinaman, Ing. Ing was their Chinaman.
His name was Ing?
Ing, I-N-G.
Huh.
He was always singing, and he was just a happy-go-lucky guy, but he was a classic Charlie Chan. I mean, he wore the outfit, he looked like him, and he was just that kind of a guy. But he was their servant. And he carried their, he brought food for the mess hall for them, and, just did everything.
I mean,
you live high in the hog if you're in the White House.
Yeah.
So your dad kind of tapered it off a little from the old hierarchy.
Yeah.
And but before, I think there was another guy that really set the tone for the strictness of how the village, how the cannery treated the local people. And it wasn't the superintendents, and it was a guy by the name of Frank Phillips.
Frank Phillips.
Yes,
yeah.
He was a superintendent. And he didn't really like native people. So, and his work, he was part of the Wind Brindle and Ralph Hendrickson from Bumblebee. And
did he work for APA?
Yeah, he went to Alaska Packers.
Yeah, I think I've seen his name.
And he hired a guy by the name of Jimmy Saradell, who was another bigot kind of a guy. It was one thing to have a superintendent that didn't like natives, but to hire a guy that run the operation to be a racist as well. I mean, there was just no way we could get into it.
Yeah.
Because I'll always remember this. Frank Saradell had two big black labs, and we were going up the beach. We used to park in the creek going up, and going up from upriver, the upriver side of the cannery, there's a creek there, and that's where we used to park our skips because it was out of the wind, and that's just where we parked our boat, our little runabouts. And there was a gangplank going up into the, up into the upper end of the hill there. And I remember one time we were walking up that, and there was Jimmy Saradell, and we had about 8 little tiny purebred Labradors, black dogs, and the dogs, he was putting them in a gunny sack, and we wanted to know, what the heck you, and he put them in the gunny sack, and he put some rocks in there, and he threw them in this tub of,
what?
This drum of water. We said, well, can we have one of them? Absolutely not. He wouldn't give the dogs away, because they were purebred. They were, they weren't mixed breed. They were pure thoroughbred dogs. And so he destroyed all of his little pups that came along. Wouldn't give any of the...
That was Phillips?
Yeah, Frank Phillips. And so Frank hired a guy by the name of Thor Ortegaard, another... I don't know if heard of Thor Ortegaard. Mm-hmm. He's the guy that ran Diamond O, Diamond O Cannery. He was a winterman down there, and he ran the crew down there. And we used to kind of hate to go to work down there. They used to put us, we would go as needed. We were part of the launch crew, and we were part of the pull-up crew, and you know, just kind of bouncing around from Diamond O, Diamond J, and NN kind of thing, wherever they needed us. And Thor Odegaard was, he was a, I would say he was a, along the same ilk as Jimmy Serrano. It, there was that strain of I mean, you ate in the native mess hall, and that's the only place right. you ate, kind of. And you didn't go into the blue room. I mean, yeah, it was really odd because you were walking up from the cannery, and my buddies that I work with go into the one, they take a right or a left into the first boardwalk, and I keep walking and walk into the other end of the mess hall, way down in the other end of the mess hall, they're eating there in the way in the corner. It was just a, but you know, it was, I didn't, it was just a way of life. I mean, what else was there?
Right.
I mean, you know, I didn't have any ill will toward that at all. I just accepted it. I mean, I got paid. In the wintertime, I would, when I needed money to go to school, I would write them a letter and they would send me a little check, you know, advance it for next year. I mean, that interest free. I mean, what else was there? So that's the kind of way, that's the way that I grew up.
Yeah. So your brother called me a couple months ago to tell me a story about when you guys were kids. And he said he remembered, and one of the stories he told me is that when you were kids, there was a Hawaiian guy who worked at the cannery named Tiny. And you liked him because he protected you guys because from, and he had all these wonderful stories about.
Yeah, he was a jitney driver. Yeah. Big, tiny, big 400 pounder.
Yeah, and it
wore
was
a little derby hat. I mean, a classic Charlie McCarthy type of outfit.
And it was amazing to me that, number one, he was talking about Hawaiians working there, and he also mentioned Mexican workers who worked at the cannery. Do you remember Mexican workers?
I can't recall any Mexican workers. I was in a different group than yeah. Ralph.
Is Ralph older than you?
No, he's younger.
Is he younger?
Than I am.
Okay.
And I was bigger, you know. So when you're big, you get to get, you know, you get on a certain list.
Yeah.
And I got to work 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
So what was it like? I mean, obviously being Native and having the kind of biased, you know, prejudiced viewpoints of, you know, the industry, like Ralph, or not Ralph, what was his name? That you mentioned,
Frank Phillips,
and others, but also it must have been pretty extraordinary as a kid, especially a young person as you're growing up, having all these people from all over the world right there.
Oh yeah,
South
definitely. It was pretty exciting, really. I mean, because I would once in a while, you know, they would all have to come to the laundry to get their blankets and stuff, so. Ralph and I would once in a while, we'd go down there, and as people would come in to get their laundry or get their blankets, we got to see who all was in the cannery. And if they took a liking to you, and a lot of the Italian fishermen did, they took a liking to Ralph and I, and so we got, you know, they would come up to the, in fact, I'm one of the better net hangers in the business, I was. Because as a growing up, that's all I, you know, they taught me how to hang nets. And then they taught me how to patch holes, big monster holes in the net. And so I got to do, because they would look at our gear that the Salabona would give us, and the holes were bigger than his house. So Mike Grillo, I don't know if you know Mike Grillo.
Yeah.
He was a net man.
Yep.
He would come up to the house and help rack on the gear, and he would, you know, tie in all these big pairs, and he would show us the knots that don't slip, and, you know, why we needed to have extra meshes here, and how to lock in our corks, and doing all those things. So that's the kind of thing that we treasured from, And then that was Louis. I mean, that was Mike Grillo, his brother. Louis Grillo was the cook. And he would come up with his little garlic and his little olive oil and his little Parmesan cheese. And, you know, he would make the best garlic bread. I'll always savor this garlic bread of his because it tastes, I mean, the way he did it, he did the bread, buttered it, garlic butter, and he even put, I think there was even tomatoes and stuff in it. It was just incredible.
Yeah. And you remember the mess hall and your...
While we're waiting for our pots to get filled, we would run around to these long walkway and stand in front of the doors. And as the fishermen came out, they would bring us their apples and oranges, ice cream, little cups, little cartons of ice cream, and they would give us, you know, they would give us the, you know, all of their dessert types on from this end, and then when they were done eating, we would go around and collect our pots and take them home and eat them.
Was it a special kind of pot, or was
these are regular cooking pots.
Yeah. How big were they, you think, usually?
Well, our family was... Well, this is during the summertime when we're fishing, but when earlier when we're not, Renee was a chef. Him and Cliff, they were both cooks at the cannery. I don't know if you remember Renee.
Mm-mm.
He was what they called the chef, soup steward. He was a chef steward, and then Cliff was another one, and they kind of took a like. They would put together boxes of food for the family, and they would bring it up to the laundry, and Mom would send us that. We'd have to go down every day to the laundry to pick up the food that they prepared for us, because Mom wasn't there to cook for us. But you know, and that's probably why I prefer sardines over smoked salmon. Because growing up, my mom didn't really spend that much time in a smokehouse. The only thing that she put together were king salmon, and that's because the kings were put up by the Italians. They took care of the strips, and we would, you know, they would get their share of it. But, you know, but eating smoked fish itself, I could never eat sockeye salmon. I just never ate it.
Well, should we take a little break? You want to take a break and then we'll...
Yeah, I've got to run pretty quick here.
Wanted to ask you about the hospital.
The hospital, Walter Craig, Doc Cragen was a doctor. He probably saved my life. He saved my brother Stephen's life. I have a massive cut in my leg. It went right into the bone.
And you said, can you say the doctor's name again?
Cragen. Dr. Cragen. Yeah, he was an old army surgeon or something. And he gave us physicals in the beginning. You know, one of the requirements of going to Sheldon Jackson High School was that we had to have physicals in South Naknek. There really was nowhere to get physicals, so Dr. Cragen would give us our physicals, and so we got to fill out the form for us. And that was one of the things that he did for us in the Anguson family. But at the hospital itself, I remember I got a deep, deep cut in my knee, right through the bone. You could see way inside, and there was just no way that... And blood was just pouring. I severed the tendon, all kinds of things, and so I remember being rushed down to the hospital, and Dr. Cragen tourniquet, and he did something, I don't know what he did, but he got the bleeding to stop, which was a miracle, and then he sewed it, and I had a bad knee for a long time, but that was Dr. Cragen there, and then my brother Stephen. He had a crushed hip, and Dr. Cragen took care of him until they met him back to Monitor.
Wow.
Yeah, he got run over by a truck going up on a motorcycle in Diamond Hill. And the truck ran over him and crushed his hip. And so Dr. Cragen probably saved his life.
Yeah, that hospital played an important role.
Oh, yes, definitely. And, there was... I like to go in there because it was always quiet.
Mm-hmm.
The only downside of Dr. Cragen was you had to pay up front, cash up front.
Well, the company didn't take care of it, though.
No, he was there not so much as a company doctor, but he was kind of like a, Providence State.
Oh, okay. So by then he wasn't an APA doctor.
He was he worked at the APA hospital.
But he wasn't.
He lived there.
Gotcha.
But because we probably weren't in his contract, we had to pay cash up front.
And the other building that I think played a big role for the community was the store too. I remember the early store.
Oh yes.
What do you remember about this store?
Well, I like the store because we got to go in there and steal candy bars every once in a while. The way they had it configured there.
I stole my few too.
Yeah, back when the store was up next to the office downstairs, that's where the first store was, and then they moved it up to the, up atop the warehouse there, but. The store itself, I remember they brought in seasonal things that we never would have access to normally. I remember Christmas stockings, Christmas candy, all kinds of different toys that they would sell during the Christmas season. I remember back around December, January, when you're out of money, if you worked for Alaska Packers, you got to charge your food and groceries and fuel until the next season. Coupled with if you owed the IRS, they would pay your tax bill. But they didn't do that for everybody, but they certainly did it for me.
Hmm.
And I'll always remember that.
Well, I know you're getting ready to take off, but is there anything really important that you think we should know about as we move forward on this project about the cannery and the community and the history?
I think that Alaska Packers has been critical to the survival of that community in more ways than one. I mean... And I think that had it not been for that cannery, I don't think South Naknek would have existed. Even though there were Bumblebee and PAF, it was Alaska Packers that was the, the service provider.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have those kind of service benefits coming from PAF or CRPA. Fuel, for example. They always made it available to any local person that wanted to buy fuel. They kept their storage tanks open, and they would have a meter there, and you go down and fill your little can or your drum or whatever. And for us, whatever we needed, I remember if I needed some machine shop part in the wintertime, I would go down to the Winterman, Grant Brown, or somebody. We would trudge down to the machine shop and scrounge around until I found a part, or if I needed a tool or a certain kind of nails or something from the carpenter shop, we'd go over there and I'd scrounge around and get the right carriage bolts or whatever. So that's the kind of life that I had at Alaska Packers.
Well,
but again, it wasn't open to everybody. You had to have been, part of, you had to have been there from the cradle to the grave, like I had been.
Yeah. Well, I told my dad I talked to him on the phone the other day, and I told him I was going to come in and interview you, and he said, you be sure to say hello, and, you tell Trefon how much I remember those days and how much they really matter.
Well, he was, Gary was the new age, and I really, he brought in a different mindset to us. And it was really hard for me to fathom because I was used to the old Frank Phillips and the K. Hank Bisons and the Norm Rocknesses. And along comes this young bookkeeper, Gary, who wore tennis shoes when everybody else wore combat boots kind of thing, you know. And so I never really got to, it took me years to finally recognize, you know, that he was different. I was always, you know, standoffish to Gary because I didn't, you know, I was just, you know, being, I wouldn't call it humble or anything. I would just say, because of the subservience role that I had with Alaska Packers since I was 10 years old, when they gave me my first boat, little 16, 18 footer with a 9-horse Johnson to Setmet. And, you know, those were important days for me. Because
mm-hmm.
nobody else had those kind of markets that I did.
Yeah.
And then as soon as I turned 18, they leased me a boat. Without even, I mean, that was it. You know, I had to be 18 to get a boat, to lease a boat, and I was one of the only, there were only, I think, three of us in the village that had leased boats from the Alaska Packers. I think my dad, Ted, and myself were the only ones that leased, that had leases for the
boat.
They're
all up there on the high catch numbers, too. I have the documents that show the rankings, and your name is always right up there at the at the top.
Well, I leave that to him these days. Well, I tell you, it's like, you know, my dad. You know, I remember Sal Labona telling him we couldn't anchor up; we had to catch 10,000 fish if we wanted to keep that boat. And so it was, and that was the first year. Sal didn't want my dad to take me out because he said I was too young. I was 13. And I was pretty big, and my dad said, no, I'm going to take my son. Sal said, you know, they gave us an AP double ender. That was the year that they went on a combine with Win Brindle. It was a poor year, slated to be a poor year, so they pulled all the canneries together, and they called what they call a combine. Between Bumblebee, Alaska Packers, and Red Salmon, if you were one of them, if you fished for one of those companies, you got to deliver to any one of those tenders. And so I remember we got this, what they call it, we had AP-10. It was a big, what they call a Squaw Creek double ender. It was a big boat, one of the biggest boats that they had. And they told my dad that he had to catch 10,000 fish with me on board in order for him to keep his market. And man, we went out and we fished. I mean, I remember wondering, what the hell? I mean, storms were upon storm. It was a stormy year, but we didn't stop for anything. Mm-hmm. Night and day, just boom, boom. And my dad is, you know, he was good at that. I remember when he got to Vera A, we were all fishing over on the west side, and the rest of us were kind of half, our boats were kind of half full, and we came up to him, and his boat was just heaping with fish, and it was blowing like crazy, and he was heading to the east side, and you know, you just have to know what you're doing in order to head, you know, when you start end of the season, you're coming up a Half Moon Bay and you're heading, and you got a 35 east, southeaster, and tides out, and you got to figure out where you want to cut across the mound below that lower ship and then turn 90 degrees once you pass your lower ship kind of, you had to know all of that because you don't have any, you know, I mean, I learned how to pick clams. in 33, I was fishing my first year. No compass, no fathometer, no nothing. And I'm fishing in Diamond M because that's the only place I just was too afraid to go out further. And so there was no fish in Diamond M. But they were catching a lot of fish up in Hungry's Flat. And so I figured, well, I'm going to go up there. And so I I pulled up and I was heading up to Hungry's plant, and I got stuck. I got stuck heading over there from Diamond M on top of the sandbar. And my dad always said that if we ever got stuck in a sandbar, throw your boat in reverse and the prop wash will build up the sand and it'll, your boat will be automatically blocked. And when the tide come in, you won't tip like that. And that'll keep you, you know, keep you from swamping. So I did that. I just threw it in reverse and built up the sand. You could feel it building, hitting. And then I went to hit the rack, and then an hour later, I heard this incredibly loud cackling sounds. Just couldn't figure out what the hell is all that noise. I happened to look out, and there was hundreds of seagulls around the boat. They were eating all the clams that I washed up. And so I jumped out, and we gathered up what was left. We got a pot of clams out of that. They were just laying on top of the sand.
Wow.
So that's how I got the big clams.
Well, I just want to... They say thank you to, and you know, one of the things that I'm noticing, the reason I'm doing this project is pretty simple, and it's because this place gave me so much, and I think it's important for me to understand my family's connection to this place. So here you have Brad here, and you know, what do you guys think? Why do you think this project is important? Why do you think the history of this place should be preserved?
Well, I think it's a legacy orientation to the community of South Mackinac. It's such a foundation for the community, both in terms of the infrastructure that it brought to the community, but as well as the economy that supported the community for many generations. And it's become evident just how important the cannery was to the community. You see that after it's shut down, and the impact that it's had. South Mackinac is nearing what we call abandonment now. It's got such a small population, and it's difficult to watch that happen. It's history unfolding before us, but that's how strong and how much of a prominent role the cannery had in the community. That's how much of an impact it was.
Yeah, I was the first, what you've heard is the first generation of local Native people. We were the first there, but after us, when your dad came along, they began to hire more and more local people to work in the canneries, the Frankie Beans and the Stanley Beans and, the Insignac. Everybody went, then, they finally got a job working there, and that was really important, that's something that it wasn't open to them in the beginning.
Yeah,
and I think that the only reason why it was open to them in the beginning is because my dad was a winterman in Diamond O, and he was a windstriver and a plumber. My mom ran the cannery, and so the rest of us got to benefit from that.
Right.
But the rest of the community didn't. Because remember I told you that there were only three boats that were leased by the... And they were to Ted, myself, and my dad. So, that tells you something.
Right.
But that was before your dad came along, and then when he came along, the local people started to get to go to work. And that's the progression, the progressiveness. And when you talk about your dad sitting in the Filipino side of the mess hall, that, that didn't come to mind at first, why he said it, people left him alone. I think it sent the signal that, you could go eat in the Filipino mess hall if you wanted to.
Sure.
You couldn't before.
Right.
You couldn't eat in the Blue Room before. You couldn't eat in the, in any of those places. The native food. I mean, I talked to some Walter. You ought to talk to guys like Walter, a good friend of mine, Jimmy Walker's boy. He grew up and working in the cannery there, and he... Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know him or not. His name is David Walker. He's Jimmy Walker's.
Is he Filipino?
No, he's a native. His dad was from the Yukon, and he did all of the recruiting for the native workers for Chignik and for Diamond E and for Diamond NN. Jimmy Walker was the recruiter.
Okay.
David, he's a friend of mine, and him and I talk all the time. We talk about the times that we used to have in South Mackinac. We talk more so, not so much the cannery, but how we used to stay alive in the bar. The pit, you know.
The pit, yes. Well, what's your favorite pit song?
Oh, Wooly Bully.
Wooly Bully, of course. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, and hopefully with this project we'll just keep going along.
If you ever need me again, I'm here.
Oh, well, I just might take you up on that.
I mean, I just cracked the surface of it.
I have a whole bunch of photos that I'll make sure you get copies of, and if you guys want to keep the map.
I'd love to.
Okay, yeah. Please do that. So. Well, thank you so much.
Right. Okay. You sure you guys never get enough to eat there?
Oh, yeah. I ate plenty. I'm good. Thank you.
Spirit took it all away.
Yeah.
Katie, I don't know if I filled this out.